WNYC Studios is supported by Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, where hundreds of researchers make new discoveries inspired by the work of previous Dana-Farber scientists. Learn more about their momentum at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Radiolab is supported by the John Templeton Foundation, funding research and catalyzing conversations that inspire people with awe and wonder. Learn about the researchers making the latest discoveries in the science of well-being, complexity, forgiveness, and free will at templeton.org/podcast.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Wait, you're listening?
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
You're listening to Radio Lab.
Radio Lab.
From
WNYC.
See?
Yeah.
And NPR.
Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radio Lab, and today we begin on a plane.
Thank you, Brooke.
Which carried our newly married producer, Tim Howard, to the Galapagos.
So I took the plane from Quito. We had just finished the honeymoon that morning, me and Brooke. They make announcements, and at a certain point, the flight attendants, they open up all of the overhead bins, and they walk up and down spraying some sort of insecticide.
For what? For like a
invasive species, I think.
Yeah, like whatever bugs might have snuck onto the plane. By this point, I'm getting super excited, and I'm thinking about Darwin, and I start reading Voyage of the Beagle, his book, on this Nook that I had bought for the trip. But then my power supply didn't work, and my Nook died.
That was a big problem for Darwin, too. He kept running out of power.
His Nook. Oh, God.
And then the islands come into sight.
What is the color of the Pacific Ocean when you look out the plane window?
That was actually the first thing I noticed. It's this totally wild, like, I've never seen, like, this storybook blue-green iridescent aquamarine. And I'm thinking, like, wow, this is going to be like dropping into another world. You know, like nature in its purest form.
My version was, is my dream of what it would be like, is you land on, and it's sort of like low, grassy knoll, and an enormous turtle comes by. The one that you could sit on the top of and it wouldn't notice that you were there.
Just kind of meets you at the airport.
Just wandering by. And
exactly.
Then,
that's very similar to what I was picturing. But we land, we take the 40-minute bus ride to Puerto Ayora.
Puerto Ayora.
Which turns out to be kind of a big town. Tons of people live there.
Tons, like a fishing village? Tons?
No, it's way bigger than a fishing village. And just let me say that my first hours in Galapagos were totally different than I was expecting.
Oh, God.
It's sort of the first thing that really just like, where the hell am I? I'm walking through the town. It's kind of late.
Sun is just starting to set.
I'm actually walking down Charles Darwin Avenue. Just kind of getting the lay of the land when all of a sudden, this line of cars comes around the corner, honking, endless honking, and they're waving flags, blue flags. At first, I didn't know what the hell was happening, but it turns out it was an election rally. And I was just really blown away that this continued, this procession, for like 15 minutes. And I remember asking one guy, they're driving so slow, I can just walk up to them. I asked the old car, I'm like, who's your candidate? And they're like,
Uccelli. Leopoldo Uccelli.
I didn't know who the guy was, but turns out he was the incumbent. And I'm like, is he going to win? And this guy, he like doesn't even say anything. He just kind of points. He like points at the cars in front and behind as if like, dude, seriously? You see how many of us there are? But then at a certain point, I noticed this one guy by himself standing on the sidewalk wearing a white shirt and jeans. He's waving a flag, but his flag is a different color. It's white. And it's really loud, but I go up to him and I yell at him, who's your candidate? And he said, I am a candidate. And I'm like, what? Are you seriously? So his name is Leonidas.
Leonidas Parrales, candidato alcalde de aquí, Puerto Ayora y La Santa Cruz.
He is a naturalist guide. You actually end up meeting a lot of people employed that way in Galapagos. And he tells me,
soy un outsider, política.
Politically speaking, he's an outsider. And of course, I'm wondering why he's standing there by himself waving a flag at this entire parade of people who don't support him at all. And he tells me,
si al momento,
well, I'm nervous.
Se eligen las autoridades que están al frente,
if the party in power now, the front runners, if they get elected,
veo un futuro oscuro e incierto.
Then I see a dark and uncertain future.
Grandes hoteles.
More big hotels, more of these enormous boats, more people. And if things keep going this way, who's going to stand up for nature?
This is Radiolab, and we are dedicating the entire hour to this little set of islands and to that question.
As the world is filling up with more and more and more people, is it inevitable that even the most sacred, pristine places on the planet will eventually get swallowed up?
And how far are we willing to go to return a place to what it was before we got there?
And more importantly, can we?
Oh, I'm never a doubter.
Okay, so this is Linda.
Linda Cayo, currently the science advisor for Galapagos Conservancy. I began my work in Galapagos in 1981.
She first came to study tortoises.
Back then, you know, Galapagos was really isolated.
Barely any cars, super limited electricity.
All I remember is having a smile on my face all the time. Because, you know, as a biologist, going to Galapagos is like going to Mecca.
She says you have islands with massive volcanoes and forests.
Tree ferns that grow, you know, well above a human's height.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, powerful colors, you know, there's green mangroves, black lava flows, and pink flamingos.
This is Matthias Espinosa,
a naturalist guide in the Galapagos.
And like Linda, he says that when he first got to the Galapagos in the 80s, he couldn't believe that the place was real.
It was breathtaking.
He visited an island called
Fernandina, and the first thing that I saw was a lava flow that was moving. And I said, what's going on? You know, no, that's not the lava flow. These are like 1,000 sea iguanas taking a sunbath.
And he says he would go on these dives.
Can you imagine schools of hammerhead sharks, like 500, 800, passing in front of you? Like tuna, I mean, like sardines. It shows you the power. It shows you also evolution. There is where evolution is very strong.
Okay, so quick context, Galapagos Islands, cluster of islands way off the coast of Ecuador in the Pacific, 19 bigger islands, bunch of smaller ones. And this is the place, of course, where Darwin landed in 1835. And as he went island to island, he started noticing that there were all of these creatures that were really similar to each other, but also a little bit different. The tortoises had different shells depending on the kind of island they lived on. The finches looked similar, but their beaks were always a little bit different. And this gets him thinking, what if it isn't the way that everybody always says? What if God didn't create every single species in the beginning and leave them unchanged? What if, in fact, life is purely change? What if everything has been changing all the time? Darwin's 5 weeks on Galapagos pushed him to develop his theory of evolution. And that's also why, when we think of evolution, we think of the Galapagos. And in particular, we think of two iconic creatures, the tortoise and the finch. Let me start by telling you about the tortoise.
It's hot, it's bright. It is such a perfect day for tortoise hunting. Or not hunting, but, you know, looking for.
Fourth day I was there, I went to the island of Floriana, which Darwin visited, and there up in the highlands, basically in the middle of this yard.
Oh my God. There are these three massive tortoises just clustered together under a tree. Wow, that is freaking amazing.
Describe them. What do they look like?
These are such alien-looking creatures.
They're like the size of, geez, I don't even know what. They're massive. They look like they would crush you to death.
I wonder how many years these guys have been here for.
They can live for over 150 years.
Wow.
This is a tortoise trying to get over a branch.
What was that? That is the sound of a tortoise breathing.
That's cool.
So Linda, when she first went to Galapagos to study these tortoises about 30 years ago...
I did a trip where we backpacked around the caldera.
She took a trip to this island called Isabella, hiked up the side of a volcano.
And looked at all the tortoise country. And it was an impenetrable forest.
Basically tortoise heaven.
And what makes it so perfect for tortoises is in the dry season in Galapagos, the garua, which is a very, very thick mist, comes onto the island.
It rolls over this forest.
And it catches in the branches of the trees.
The water then drips down from the top of the trees down to the ground,
creating what we call drip pools, which provides tortoises with water during the dry season, and they like to rest in water.
And so there, under the trees, you have these ponds with dozens of tortoise domes just rising out of the water.
So that was my first experience. It was a magical, magical area. And then I actually didn't get back there for maybe 15 years from when I was there the first time. And when I returned, that forest was 100% gone. The drip pools were just dry dust bowls.
Wow.
There was no shade.
Tortoises were sitting out in the sun or crowded around the couple of storks that were still there.
This is Carl Campbell.
I work for Island Conservation, and I'm based here in the Galapagos Islands.
Carl's actually the guy who showed me those tortoises.
It was just a barren landscape.
Yeah, barren, barren grounds.
What happened to the forest?
Goats.
Goats.
That was definitely not what I thought you were going to say. I thought you were going to say people.
It was kind of a collaboration. So here's the story.
Goats were originally sort of brought to the Galapagos probably by pirates and whalers.
Back in the 1500s, you had tons of sailors making these long voyages across the Pacific.
And Galapagos was, you know, the major port on the whaling route where... You know, you'd come and get fresh water, but you'd also come in and pick up tortoises, land tortoises. And, you know, boats would take away several hundred of them often and turn them upside down, and they can last for up to a year and a half in the hold of a ship.
Like lying there upside down?
Yeah, lying there upside down.
In order to make space for the tortoises, the whalers and pirates would often take goats that they'd brought with them and throw them onto the islands. That way, when they're on their way back and sick of eating tortoises, they could grab those goats. So whalers and buccaneers, they introduced goats to Galapagos. But on islands like Isabella, which is this massive island, size of Rhode Island, the goats were actually penned in to just a little part of it. Because there was this black lava rock that ran across the island.
Extremely rough lava that's extremely difficult to walk across.
12 miles of it.
So that had acted as a barrier.
Basically with goats on one side, tortoises on the other. But according to Linda...
Sometime in the late 1970s...
The goats got brave.
I mean, we're probably talking just a few goats. But by the 1990s, those few goats, the population had exploded to about 100,000 goats.
Wow.
And if you think of 100,000 goats eating everything in their path...
Every sort of plant, like even the bark off of trees...
They destroy the forest.
So now they had a dilemma. You know, on the one hand, the tortoises needed help. On the other hand, you had all of these goats that didn't choose to be on the island. You know, it wasn't their fault.
And the goats that were out there were gorgeous. You know, they had curled horns, different colored fur, just beautiful animals.
And they've been there for 500 years.
Some people were concerned, you know, with goats have their own sort of, if you will, right to be there. Those arguments came up frequently.
To which Carl would respond.
Yeah, are we going to let tortoises go extinct? Yeah, there's thousands of islands around the world that have goats on them.
These tortoises are only found here.
So where do your values lie?
And so in 1994, we had what we called a tortoise summit in England. And that was where we started the discussions about what are we going to do.
Experts came from all over the world. Linda says, we want to get rid of the goats.
And many of them thought we were nuts and that it was impossible.
There's 100,000 of them.
So many doubters.
Carl says he even heard the idea.
Why don't you put lions? you know, they eat goats in Africa, you know, why don't you get lions on there? And those are, you know, really interesting ideas, but at some point they're going to get hungry and they're going to start eating all the other things that, you know, you treasure, like the occasional tourist.
In any case, after endless planning and meetings...
Took 8 years, I think.
They commence Project Isabella.
So the helicopters we used, they're called MD-500s, small helicopter. They're for four passengers and one pilot, single turbine, five blades.
This is Fraser.
Fraser Sutherland. I was the engineer, pilot, and a sharpshooter, 2004 through to 2006.
Almost every day during that time, Fraser would fly over Isabella Island. Two guys with him.
Two shooters, either side of the helicopter. What you do is, so you come across and you're flying along and you might see one goat.
Says you'd follow that goat as it ran away till it joined its friends.
So you have to find all those other goats.
Circle real low.
You'd fly around them.
Round them up.
Try and get them in a single group.
And then...
you start picking off the goats one by one by one. And there are actually videos online where you see these packs of goats running for their lives and then dropping to the ground.
The last goat or two might sort of run into a area where it's impossible to reach.
They'll actually go into caves, and what we'd do is we'd find a location as close as we could or right on top of the cave, drop out one of the two shooters that was in the helicopter, and he'd physically go into the cave, shoo the goats out, or shoot them on sight.
And then you go on.
And actually, in under a year through this aerial attack, they end up wiping out 90% of the goats on Isabella.
But to give an example of the nature of this business...
That's Josh Dunlin. He runs an NGO that was involved in Project Isabella.
It's relatively easy to remove 90% of a goat population from an island. But as they become rarer and rarer, they're harder and harder to detect.
The goats become, quote, educated. They learn that this sound means... So the goats start hiding.
So they go into bushes, they won't move.
They'll learn to stand under a tree, holding their breath.
And so you end up flying around in an expensive helicopter, not finding any goats. Now the way we deal with that is an interesting one. We use this technique called Judas goats.
Yeah, Judas goats.
Initially it was Carl's suggestion.
Because goats are gregarious and like being in groups.
They're herd animals, right? And so... the technique that we would use was you would fire up your helicopter, you fly around, you'd find some goats. You'd
capture goats.
Capture them live.
And then come back.
Back to base camp.
Offload them.
And you put a radio collar on them and you throw them back on the island.
And then you wait. Instinctively.
That lone goat will go and find other goats.
A week, 2 weeks go by. You fire up the helicopter.
They get back over the island with this little device.
It's a directional antenna.
Start tracking the Judas goat till they spot it with some other goats.
And then everyone gets shot except the Judas goat.
They let it go, finds more friends.
And then everyone gets shot except the Judas goat.
And then they do it again.
Everyone gets shot except the Judas goat. And you do that every 2 weeks for a year.
Oh my God. And that is how they go from 90% goat free to 91 to 92 to 93 to 94.
It's like having a pogrom on you over and over
I know,
and over
it's
again.
Like, Jesus.
It gets worse.
Now, a Judas goat is a good Judas goat until it gets pregnant.
Because then it doesn't want to be social anymore.
It goes off and has his kid and is very solitary. Which is the last thing you want when you're trying to get goats off islands.
So Carl kept mulling this problem.
What would it take to basically make, you know, the perfect Judas goat? The ideal Judas goat, if you will, is a goat that would search for and be searched for.
And that would never get pregnant.
So Carl Campbell figured out a technique where we could sterilize them in the field.
They'd grab the goats, dart them, and then in a matter of minutes...
Snip, snip.
Did you do this?
Yeah, well, I stood next to Carl and watched him do it. And Carl took it one step further, and he actually gave these females hormone implants.
It basically put them into heat.
For an extended duration.
Normally, a female goat would be in heat for maybe a couple of days. These females would go...
For more than 180 days.
And wherever they went, they would lure those male goats out of their caves so that, you know. All in all, over the course of this two-year program,
we had hundreds of Judas goats out.
And using those goats, they were able to go from 94% goat-free to 96 to 97 to 98.
And basically, when you have only Judas goats meeting up with other Judas goats,
then you can say the goats have been eliminated.
That you're done.
A point they got to, at least on Isabella, in mid-2006.
This kind of eradication program was far beyond anything that anyone had ever done anywhere in the world.
Because, turns out, they weren't just doing this on Isabella Island.
No, we're talking about island by island.
Over the course of about 7 years, they eliminate over 250,000 goats. So, you complete that with Isabella, and did it work?
Yeah, the results of this were absolutely impressive.
You had plants reemerging, you had trees growing back.
And in a really short period of time.
And this allowed for those important drip pools. And tortoises, they basically got their home back.
This is the real thing. Tortoises walking around. It's incredible.
So they did it. They got all the goats.
Not all the goats.
What do you mean?
Those Judas goats, they kept them around.
Why?
I would have shot them first just out of sympathy for them.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, they needed the goats because, well, there was the problem of people. Because during the 90s, these demonstrations started to happen.
Demonstrations of outrage and violent activity. Constant conflict.
To explain.
Lo que pasa es que la época de que esto de la pesca.
This is Augustine Lopez, longtime fisherman, and he told me that in the 70s and 80s,
la langosta se pescaba todo el año corrido.
Lobster was fished all year round.
No había época de veda.
No restrictions, and then fishermen started making a killing fishing sea cucumber because there was this huge demand. But then the national park comes in, same group that's doing the goat eradication. And they tell the fishermen they're overfishing the sea cucumber, they've got to limit their catch. And the fishermen are like, who are you to tell me that I can't feed my family? So they lash out. They march down Charles Darwin Avenue.
They would come down the street throwing rocks and sticks and everything. And
that's Paul Watson, founder of the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society. He was there counter-protesting, and he says that at one point they went after national park buildings.
And they were attacking the ranger stations with Molotov cocktails.
They blockaded roads.
They literally drove the rangers out of the national park headquarters and took it over.
On Isabella, they burned down a building.
They kidnapped some people, including some of my crew.
And they even killed dozens of tortoises, slitting their throats. According to some accounts, they even hung them from trees. Not only that, but according to Linda, those goats?
A couple islands where they've been eliminated, fishermen have put them back.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
And so what they decided to do is leave the Judas goats on various islands where they can live out their sterilized days, chomping on grass, sharing war stories, until such time as they might be needed again.
Is the war between the greens and the fishermen and such, is that still hot and difficult, and are they still, you know, killing tortoises? And
they're not the fishermen. They seem to have stopped, you know, taking over the national park and killing tortoises.
You know why?
It's a combination of reasons. On the one hand, fishermen have started to participate in the actual fisheries management more, because it seems like they realize if they're going to keep their livelihood, they can't just fish everything out. But then at the same time, the tourism economy has been taking off. And so all of these fishermen, they find that it's easier for them to actually survive
by using their boats to take tourists around island to island. So they're all kind of converting over into the tourism economy.
Huh.
We're going to take a short break. This is Radiolab. We'll be back with producer Tim Howard and this hour on Galapagos in just a moment.
Hi, this is Linda Kyle.
Hey, this is Josh Donlin.
Radiolab is supported in part by the National Science Foundation
and the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation,
enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
More information about Sloan at
www.sloan.org.
Sloan.org.
Bye.
Ciao.
End of message.
Radiolab is supported by the John Templeton Foundation, funding research and catalyzing conversations that inspire people with awe and wonder. Learn about the researchers making the latest discoveries in the science of well-being, complexity, forgiveness, and free will at templeton.org/podcast.